You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Without further ado, I think, let's put our hands together for the wonderful Hannah and Alice.
Thank you so much. And thank you all so much for being here. When we went back there, there was no one, and now there's a beautiful cluster. It is my absolute pleasure to be joined by Hannah Silver, who is the author of My Child, The Algorithm. This book, it's a quiet gift to society, to a society that is afraid of artificial intelligence. Written by Hannah, Hannah's toddler, and an algorithm, it is truly radical in approach, and it exemplifies how we can work with tech to lift up and chew over the most human and raw parts of our nature. This raw portrayal of queer single parenting and love embraces the flexibility of self as Hannah's world expands and contracts with the pleasures and pains of new parenthood, and truly, it is a stunning piece of art. It left me as a new parent feeling really real, and that might sound like an odd thing to say, but anybody that has felt real through art will know what a gift Hannah has given to me. So at this time where big tech rages through our lives, it's unmissable, it's urgent, it's threatening, this book is a vital reminder that there are other queer, tender, beautiful, painful ways that we can engage with and relate to this tech. So Hannah is a critically acclaimed writer, performer. Their work spans BBC radio dramas. They've won awards. They've got 2 decades of critically acclaimed poetry and performance behind them. And it is my huge pleasure to welcome Hannah Silver to Greenbelt.
Thanks so much. Thank you so much for coming to this. Thank you, Alice, for that really gorgeous intro. That's my favourite one.
Oh, you're so welcome. Hannah's going to start with some reading. While Hannah does that, could somebody help me lift my microphone? Because I'm going to look really weird all the time, bending down like this.
You can probably just tip it up a bit.
Do you reckon? Just like this?
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, I'm in. Yeah, thank you. So yeah, I'm going to hand to Hannah to open this with a reading before we have a conversation.
Okay, yeah, lovely. So I started working on this book a few years before ChatGPT was released and, you know, sped into our lives. And at the time I was working on it, a lot of people didn't know what it was that I was doing. My agent and editor didn't really know, and I had to explain to them. And a little bit of this intro is giving much more explanation than would probably be needed now. But they were like, is it a robot? Are you walking around with it? I'm like, no. At the same time, what I was working with is not ChatGPT. It has nothing to do with OpenAI. It was an open source model released by grassroots researchers called Eleuther AI. And this is not a book about AI. It's a book about queer single parenting and love. I'm going to read a little bit and then explain a little bit and then read another little bit and then we'll chat. Also, I have to let you know, this is my algorithm voice. I don't know how to do it. Hopefully you will be able to distinguish me and the algorithm. The algorithm and the toddler are unreliable narrators, but may have a more reliable approach to love than the one found in love poems and love songs and romantic films, which cannot be trusted because they are written by writers. I know that writers cannot be trusted in love because I am one and I have loved one. I don't know how to do it. How do you do it? I don't know if I can do it. I'm not sure how to do it. Writers cannot be trusted in love, and writers cannot be trusted in writing. Beware memoirs, says Abdul Razak Gurnah, who also says, language is the antagonist. The algorithm is language. The algorithm is the antagonist. I'm wrestling with it, and it screams at me. It doesn't let me choose where to go. Sometimes it hits me, and playing with it is fun. Although I say I'm writing this book with a machine learning algorithm and a toddler, in fact, I think that because I'm the one organising the material, I am the writer of this book, and the algorithm will not be getting any royalties. The toddler, however, will be eating, wearing, and playing with any royalties. The algorithm died, put on a suit, cut up its body, and said, "Goodbye." I can access a simple version of the algorithm online. I connect to the Wi-Fi using the password, "Hipster cafes are like really cool, boring libraries," and pull up the webpage. It consists of two boxes. One where you type in your questions or statements, and one underneath that displays the algorithm's response. I tell the algorithm I want to think about love and queer parenting and bodies and failure, all right? The toddler has taken to adding "all right" to the end of his statements. "Hit mummy, all right?" I hit generate, which is a euphemism for "right" or vice versa. And then I sit back against the wall of this Hackney cafe. After a few seconds, the algorithm responds, "What is love? Is it an emotion? Is it an action? How does it work? What do we feel? What do we do?" I'd suggest that you find out how to answer these questions. This is not just about writing, it is about real life. The answers are in your life. All right? So that's how it tricked me into writing about my life for the first time, really. And this, so by algorithm, I mean large language model. Nowadays, with the, you know, the ones released by big tech, you put in a question and you'll get an answer. At this time, you put in some text and you got some text that continued what you put in. So if you put in a question, you would get more questions, and maybe you would get a list and list and list of questions, and it would keep going and keep going, which was quite fun for me. You'd also get a lot of glitching and repetitions and failures, and I started to really enjoy the failures and the repetition. So it glitched on the phrase, "fail to save the world as it ought to be, but there is a but. Fail to save the world as it ought to be, but there is a but." And sometimes these repetitions are quite moving to me. I remember I was writing about a scene where I was in a cafe and I was observing a mother and a father and a baby having this conversation with each other. And I was on my own with my baby. And the algorithm glitched on this phrase, "I will go on my own and I will be fine. I will go on my own and I will be fine. I will go on my own and I will be fine." And I had this phrase looping around my head, which is also kind of how my thoughts work. So the way in which the algorithm is generating text is also the way in which my mind works and gets stuck and loops on ideas, and how I've always worked in performance. I work with loop stations quite a lot, where a phrase will loop and loop and loop. And then there's some really fun bits. Like, I asked the algorithm to write a scene depicting a codependent relationship between two women in love. And it wrote, "breasts, breasts, 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 265 times. And then concluded, "all women in love." I did get to include that in the book, and you can see how many pages of breasts I managed to get in there. And I have sometimes performed all of them, but I'm sparing you that today. There's also a glitchy phrase which I really enjoyed performing, which goes, "very sad person. Huh? You know what? We're really fucking it up, aren't we? Yeah, that is really fucking up, isn't it? Yeah, we're really fucking up. Yeah, that is really fucking up, isn't it? Really fucking up. Yeah, we are really fucking up, isn't it? Yeah, we are really fucking up, aren't we? We are really fucking," et cetera, et cetera. I'll just do another kind of page or so of, just kind of showing how I was working with it. In the book, everything written by the algorithm is in italics. It felt important to me to show at that point what was large language model and what was me. But we can question that, you know, where the two bleed into each other. And yeah. And I'm kind of cutting and splicing it together. So it wasn't a linear exercise. I wasn't writing a bit, getting a response, putting that in. You know, I had pages and pages and pages of algorithm text, which was a response to loads of things that I fed it. Extracts from my diary, voice notes from people I'd been dating, quotes about love, all sorts of things. And I got so many pages back from it, it took me weeks just to read it through. And then I selected from that the things that hit me and the things that kind of swerved my writing into different directions, and it kind of gets interspersed. So yeah, just another little bit about that, really. The algorithm doesn't do what I want it to do. It's like the toddler because it gets stuck on a thought and repeats it over and over. And it's like the toddler because when I tell it which direction to go in, it wants to go a different way. No, mummy, this way, mummy. We're returning from the playground and it's taking forever because the toddler wants to stop for a feather, a leaf, a swing, and a woman riding a bike with her cat in a basket. As they pass, the toddler says, "Miss bike, mummy," and cries all the way home. My children make the sound of a tap on the window. They make the sound of a television. They make the sound of a washing machine. They make the sound of a pen in a dry paper bag. They make the sound of a hearth pit fire in the fireplace after their long dead mother has disappeared. I have mourned her, but to my son, she is becoming more and more alive. Sometimes she says, "Our son," and it grates the way it grated when a director I worked with said, "Our play." That is not a good comparison. I hear a mother say, "My child and my mother," at a dinner party where all children are sparkling. He is my son to me and also my son to her. I am like a child. I don't want to share. I don't want to share my child. I don't want to feel like I carried him and gave birth to him so that she and her partner can run around their garden every evening at dusk, shouting such things as, "My son, willy-nilly." I say "willy-nilly" to the toddler and he laughs. I tell him there's a hyphen in it. "Ah, yes," he replies. Motherhood is an abuse of children. There is no hyphen in stepmother. I'm not good at predicting the future.
Thank you. I think we should give those readings a clap.
Thank you.
Particular clap for the algorithm voice, which I feel very lucky to have heard. And I wonder how many versions of the algorithm voice were tried out before you landed on this one. That gave you a beautiful sense, I think, of this deeply creative book. I hadn't, at this time when this book was written, heard of anything that was written like this. And I wonder, what on earth made you think, I'm going to write a book with my toddler and I'm going to write a book with an algorithm?
Just standard thought you have of a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, these things, they always build in layers and you never get to the final thought. You don't, you know, it takes a lot of thoughts to get to anything. Mm. But initially I was put together with a cognitive linguist who was working with AI models at the time. So again, this was about 2019, 2020. And we were put together with also a radio producer, Afonica, supported by the Wellcome Trust, to do some research and to write a radio play. So this book actually began as a radio play called An Artificially Intelligent Guide to Love, I think. Yeah, which is still available on Listen Again on just Radio 4. So I started it through that. Mm-hmm. And the James Carney I was working with, I sent him stuff to give the algorithm, which again, it's not like... There was a model I could access online, but it's not really like how you'd do it today. And we were changing things around it. We were adjusting the temperature, the parameters, finding the spot where it was poetic and made me excited to write and inspired me. I didn't want it to be too accurate,
yeah.
Which is another, you know, thing we can get into, the way the models are developed. Now there's so many parameters on them that, you know, they wouldn't do this. They're prevented from a lot of things that also prevents poetry. So I started through that book. And I think just reading the responses from the algorithm text and being moved by them and feeling like it put me in a kind of heightened state of thought made me feel like, okay, I'm onto something. This is something I want to keep doing. It just developed. And then at some point the radio play was done and I thought, oh, I wonder if this could be a book. And at that point, I'd spent a year with a different book, sending it off to agents and not getting anywhere with it. And then I just, I wonder if this could be a book. Mm. And quite quickly wrote a book proposal for it and sent it to some agents and got interest immediately. Which is very unusual in my life. So I thought, okay, this is yeah. maybe something. Yeah.
I love that you said the algorithm elevates you into a heightened state of thought, because often as creative people, we are very afraid of AI because it's going to crush the creative industries. It's going to replace all kind of artistry. But what you're saying is it elevated you into this other, potentially more creative space. And in the book, you write about Jeanette Winterson talking about alternative intelligence rather than artificial intelligence, which is something I might bring into my lexicon, start calling it AI alternative intelligence. Could you talk a bit about what that is and the opportunities, the space that opens up within creative practice?
Yeah, I mean, I did steal that from Jeanette Winterson. And she mentions that in her book, 12 Bytes, that was also published quite a long time before AI kind of burst into everyone's consciousness. Obviously, AI has been around for a very long time, but in terms of public use of it. And she says, basically, it's not artificial and it's not intelligent. And there's plenty of people who've pointed that out. And so she says, let's not call it artificial intelligence. Let's call it alternative intelligence. It feels more accurate. We need alternatives. Which I agree with. And I think for me, it gave me an alternative way of thinking, of writing. I was asking, could it give me an alternative way of living, of loving, of parenting? My book is a lot about alternatives, trying to find alternatives, because, the plan that I had to have a kid with my ex-partner, at that time, my partner, that didn't happen. That all blew up to borrow the way Miranda July talks about things blowing up. It's probably not the right language, but I'm a big fan of it. Anyway, like that all went quite disastrously not to plan when I gave birth. So I had to think about alternatives, and I had to find my alternative self as well, and my alternative self as a parent. It's a way of... And the algorithm would come up with these lines like, it is a pain, I am queering. I thought, it is a pain that I'm queering. Yeah.
And that's the other great thing about this book. There's all the interesting possibilities around AI, which we'll unpack a little bit more. But there's also just, from a kind of gossip perspective, it's richly socially interesting what is happening to you in this time of your life. And I wonder if you could speak a bit about the people, the social landscape of your life when you wrote this book. Like, what is it about people-wise?
I don't think I've ever been asked that before, and I've never really talked about that. Interestingly,
page turn because you what? And then the algorithm goes, yeah, like that is this interplay between you read right, the algorithm is backing us up.
I think, again, like the lovely thing about changing everything about your life quite suddenly is it opens you up to conversations and people and a new way of thinking about everything. If you question one thing, you start questioning everything. And so I was questioning love and families and parenting and all of the things. And I was dating as well, and that brought me into like meeting a lot of different people. And I think also when somebody sees you, when you've got a new baby and you're suddenly being left and all this stuff, people have pity, I suppose, but in a way that makes them come close to you and actually start talking. So I think I had quite a lot of rich conversations with different people around that time through being in that situation, but then also through just dating. And people would say kind of astonishing things about the way in which they parented or the things that they would say to their children. It's a mix of truth and fiction. Don't go by everything that's in here. I may have made it up or taken it from something that somebody else said about something else at some other time. There's a friend that recurs in this book, my bee-killing friend. That's what I call her. And because she accidentally killed bees, it wasn't on purpose.
She was so sad. She was very sad about it,
yeah. She was at the time desperate for children, it was everything that she wanted in her life, and very much a nuclear family as well. She wanted a wife and children. And the ways in which she would talk about IVF and the way she would talk about having a child that was not genetically her child was everything that I hate. It's everything that I disagree with, really. So she became quite a useful person to have in the book because she can say the things that I disagree with, but the things that a lot of people feel, my child will not be my child. Yeah. And I talk quite a lot about, well, in a way called My Child, the Algorithm, but the book is a lot about saying, I don't own anybody. You know, children don't belong to anybody. He is my child and is not my child. And he happens to not be made from my egg. He was made from the egg of my partner then, and I gave birth to him. So genetically, he is not my genetics.
Yeah.
And I was trying to find a way to handle the multiple truths of him being my child and not being my child. And, you know, I'm not saying that he's not my child because it's not genetically my child. I'm saying it because none of us own our children.
Yeah. And I love that your bee-killing friend was able to be that bounce off, and maybe she didn't actually say all the things, because as a new parent, you never get to finish conversations. So I think it's amazing that you were like, no bother, I'll fill them in. I'll end them in the book. I really like that. Yeah, it's cool. In terms of the AI that's interspersed throughout this book, so often when we think about artificial intelligence, it's to speed us up, get things done, efficiency, productivity. Whereas what you've done in this book, to my mind, is slowed us down with AI. You will write something pretty kind of stunning and heavy and kind of whoa, and then the AI enables me to think, do I agree with that? What do I think? Can I reflect? We don't normally get that in kind of literary devices. So one of them was you talk about your partner leaving you and your child right after your child was born. And I'm almost in tears when I'm reading this. And then the AI writes, are we ever happy with just a little bit of love? And I'm like, oh my gosh, are we? I don't know. And I'm thinking on my own life. And it's just, yeah, that juxtaposition was so clever. And I wonder, did AI help you find meaning in your own life during this time? Or was it just a literary device to help us, the reader?
Oh, not at all. Wasn't thinking about you guys. No, all about me. it enabled me to write it. And it also said the things that, sometimes it said things that I thought but wouldn't dare write. Sometimes it just said the subtext to what was going on at the time. Sometimes it interrupted me and made me just go somewhere else in the writing. It enabled me to write the book, but it didn't make it any easier or any faster. Absolutely not. And I think, again, now that people have a certain idea of what it is and how you work with it, they think, oh, so AI wrote it. Like, no, I wrote it. Yeah. And I use these texts from AI. And I'm calling it AI. It's not AI anyway, but, you know, large language model outputs to create layers of meaning, I think, and to write in a less linear way. And our lives are not very linear, and the way we think is often not very linear. So it changed the way I write and changed the way I thought. And I think, for me, that's what's exciting about writing. And I think that's what a lot of writers are, we are looking for and striving for, is ways to write and think differently. And I'm excited about the possibilities for this kind of hybrid intelligence, and the AI part's not intelligent. Humans are the intelligent ones. But ways in which we can work with it to think and write in different ways. And that said, of course, the ways in which the models are generally developed and released by big tech is antithetical to that. Like, that's absolutely not making that happen. But yeah, there are alternatives.
Yeah. Mm. The other theme, and I say other as if it's separate and it's not, but the theme that recurs is this kind of fracturing of self. You're so interested in echoes and shadows and mirrors, and it was an echo that made you think, hey, I think I want a child. I loved that. But the bit that I had to put the book down because it was too painful was when you talked about in pregnancy and in postpartum, you said you can't endure your body stretching out of identity. And I really have felt that after having my children. And I look in the mirror, I'm like, who even is that? And it scares me because I feel like I didn't know my identity was based in my outward presentation from a feminist perspective. And I wonder, how do you grapple with that in your life and in this book? You are inside, you are outside, and it's shifting and stretching. And I wonder if you could just speak about who we are and how we change fundamentally.
Oh, God. Oh, my word.
I know you can, because that's what this is all about.
But yeah, again, it's probably something I can do in a book and I can't do in a speech. Anyway, there's a thing when you become pregnant that people just like look at your belly. They just think they have a right to it as well. I mean, not the first person to point that out.
I hope no one ever went, can I?
Oh, yeah, you know, people do that.
As they.
Yeah. And then if you become a parent, you know, the AFAB people who are you know, parents kind of, then you're in the context of nursery and schools and everything, you just become mum. You just get called mum by all the adults. Mm. Like the teacher, gosh, you're just your mum. It's really like every time it happens, like, what? Who?
Not your mum.
yeah, so, you know, of course that happens to identity. And then I think, yeah, you talk about outward presentation and feminism, and but there's also gender going on there. Yeah. And, you know, it can feel very feminine to, it is a very feminine, you know, to become pregnant. And then around that time, I'd also grown my hair because my partner then had short blonde hair and people thought we were sisters, and that was horrible. So I felt like I had to be different. But then that made me feel like not myself. And, but, you know, all that to say, I think I have found my identity in a much kind of stronger, and yeah, I enjoy it much more now since having a kid than I did before. Like I've come into a self much more than I was previously. Yeah,
I love that, because so often people report the opposite, these kind of wilderness years postpartum where you don't know who you are aside from in relation to your child. And I love that you have risen through that feeling the opposite.
Yeah, I just didn't have that experience. And I know a lot of people do, but I can't relate. I think perhaps because I knew it was at risk, perhaps I knew my life and identity was at risk, that I put a lot of, you know, I very much did the opposite and cultivated friendships and enjoyed dating and sex and all these things that as new mothers you're, you know, apparently not interested in. But yeah, it was like, I won't let this take any life away from me. And it certainly made me write in ways that I'd never written before as well.
Yeah. And that's what's so powerful about this book, because it is bursting at the seams with life, with people, with ideas, with feelings. And yet you're staring at your child, you're watching Peppa Pig, you're giving them beans. It's like your inner life is going
not
full.
Not Peppa Pig.
Dougie, that's the one your
hey,
kid
Dougie,
likes.
Yeah.
Hey Dougie, there we are. Okay, so I'm going to ask one more question. Then Hannah is going to do a reading, and then we're going to turn for questions. So this is your kind of little warning to let your ideas twinkle. And if you don't have questions, I've got a whole page more, so don't feel the stress, but that will be your chance. So my last question in this segment is around, I borrow from the artist Stephanie Dinkins and often call myself an accidental technologist. I've kind of slipped into this space, but deliberately, politically, I'm staying put. And I wonder what your advice is to people that don't see themselves as technologists, aren't big into tech, but maybe are creative or are committed to justice and want to do something like this. How do we lean in to tech without leaning into big tech?
Yeah, good question. I am, ask me again in a year, because I'm going to work on that over the next year. But there are, I guess it doesn't take too much searching to find grassroots models that have been made available by researchers that you can play with. I think my question, I suppose, with where I'm going with this next is the buggy, glitchy, queerer, I'd say, model that I worked with in this book. They have a kind of voice and a tone, and other people worked with them, have worked with them, and they've got a similar tone to them. And I feel like I've done it now. You know, I pushed it quite far in this book, and I don't want to repeat this book. Mm. And I also want to understand what it is that people are working with and engaging with on a daily basis, because I think that's something that our children are growing up with and that we need to know about and understand. And I think it's a problem when writers just wholesale dismiss technology, especially when we are all using so many other technologies every day of our lives. So, you know, in a way, I want to find out what we can do with the existing models. And I have played around with that. And I have found ways of working with them, but it's very difficult to get them to be creative. Mm. I think that more smaller models are emerging, and more ethical groups, researchers and companies, and particularly within academia, but elsewhere, who are working on models that are trained with, you know, ethical data sets where they've got permission. And yeah, I'm curious about models that are designed to be creative, but the people creating these models don't really know what that is. And I suppose none of us quite know what that is. And the question of what is creativity, me and Margaret Bowden wrote a book on this, The Creative Mind, which has really impacted AI in terms of thinking about creativity and AI. I mean, yeah, but I think that, you know, that's a really important question. And or in terms of AI, I'm not interested in it, and I've never have been. I'm interested in humans, but it's often we need to look outside of humans to understand ourselves in different ways. And I think that's what exploring these technologies, preferably outside of big tech, can do.
That's perfect. I also think that what you said earlier, we could kind of use as a North Star, is not how can AI speed us up, make us more efficient, but what did you say, lift us into a heightened state of thinking? So when you're typing into ChatGPT, are you using it to like flatten out your ideas and get your email off quicker, or are you using it to elevate yourself? And your
yeah, well, you won't be able to use ChatGPT in a way to elevate.
Do you not
thought
think?
No, definitely. I mean, I've tried with Claude. To be honest, Claude 3.5 Sonnet is a bit more fun, and there's access to a huge amount of knowledge and information that, you know, a single person doesn't usually have, and we can use that, and we can use their ability to generate lists that go on and on and on, or their ability to write in scientific language or technical language, or translate something into a different form or into mathematical code, or, you know, there's lots of things that these models are actually very good at that we might not be able to do ourselves. So that's quite fun. Yeah. And process of translation across multiple languages. Yeah, that's kind of, so I'm trying to find ways working with them creatively, but it's definitely a challenge.
Yeah, and getting harder, which is a shame. So we will hear one more reading, and then we will turn to the floor for questions.
Do you want a longer reading or a short reading?
Whichever you would prefer. I think maybe a middle size. So it's 20... Okay, let's go for a short reading, because to be fair, they can buy the book and read the book, but we won't get their questions again. Okay. So let's go short reading question.
Okay, so if you want a short reading, you can have the little bit about dating. Yeah, that was a 2-page, it will do. Okay, so this chapter's called Sex Without Love. In Sex Without Love, the poet Sharon Olds compares those who can have sex without love to long-distance runners, striving only for their own pleasure, a body running against its own best time. She exalts the way they can come to the still waters without loving the one who came there with them. And her poem stutters its coming, repeats as if the poem itself is panting, breathless. Come to the. What if I fell off the road, off my bicycle, into my life? I have had sex without love, and I have had sex with love, and I have had that dream sex madness where in the moment you want whatever they want forever. Yes, I'll adopt 3 children with you and build a house in the woods. Moments later, you look at them and remember you don't know who they are. Being alone is impossible. I realise that there's a whole other side to sex. There's double what I thought there was to this. I can be turned on in ways I never imagined. I can feel what the other feels. And I realise that sex can be as much in the imagination as love is. Queer is finding the way to come to the still waters and to come alone. I will be turned on if you are turned on. I will be happy if you are happy. You must be happy, so I am happy. If you are unhappy, I am unhappy. We look in the mirror and we see a reflection or a double or an echo or unhappiness. The dark noise that sighs in the place where mirrors are. And the desire that sighs in the place where the mirrors are. The desire that sighs where the reflective surfaces are. And the desire that sighs where the mirrors are. Once, I could only be happy when my partner was happy. And when she was unhappy, I was unhappy. And she could not conceal her unhappiness in order to protect my happiness. But perhaps by attempting to conceal her unhappiness, she got unbearably thirsty and I drowned. Do you want to be happy or do you want to be in love? Neither. I'm just horny. I open the apps and swipe away a large number of profiles. I take myself seriously. I am not emotionally available or willing to be vulnerable. No need to invest in me. I'm not on the market or a catch or the whole package. I don't have good vibes only. My child and I are not a package deal, and he is not baggage. I don't want to be a life partner or big love or forever person or the one. I cannot promise no drama. I am a dramatist. I am not the real deal, and I do not know who I am or what I want. But I do know that I don't want to tangle myself into another person until I don't know what is me and what is them. I don't want to be wrapped up so completely that I look at a hand, a limb, and don't know which of us it belongs to, because it doesn't matter. It belongs to us both, mine or yours, hers or hers. It's especially seductive to confuse pronouns and body parts when the pronouns and body parts are the same, but different. There's nothing, not even a new name, to help you tell from which one person is I and which is a next person. There is, as in a person, so much more than just one name and only one way.
Thank you. Thank you, Hannah. So I think we've got a roving mic or roaming mic over here. So have we got any questions? I'm going to try and survey. We do. Okay, I can see one, two, three over here. So just one, two, and then a third hidden in the bush. Yes, if we go lovely green hair, and then the brilliant person beneath them, and then there's somebody over here afterwards.
I was just wondering, what's your, I don't know, take on like the environmental impact of the use of, you're looking at me like you predicted that question, the environmental impact of, I guess I'm mostly thinking about ChatGPT, but like the, yeah, I guess learning algorithms as well. I don't know what the difference is.
What the difference is between, what was you say at the end there, sorry?
ChatGPT between and, like, I guess like the big tech ones. And yeah, whatever it was that you were using. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah, the one I was using would be a bit different. They can, a lot different, I suppose, because you can develop small models based on much smaller data sets that are also going to be, they're going to be a lot glitchier and more reflective of the content that is in them. And the one I was using was one developed by grassroots researchers and was like a small model. I mean, what's my take? I mean, obviously, my take is we need to protect the environment. It's hard to say to talk about without sounding like it's making excuses for it, because I'm not, like, I don't support big tech in any kind of a way. Definitely not. And at the same time, that big tech is also behind all of the other tech that we are using every day, behind Google and social media, and all of these things use all of the same stuff and have the same environmental impact. So the society that we are in, not necessarily globally, but here, we are using it, engaging with it all of the time. And we can go, oh, okay, yes, does this use water? Ah, oh, but it's the same amount of water as making a cup of tea, so maybe that's okay. I don't know. I don't support big tech, and I don't support the capitalism that our society is built on. And it's everywhere. People are engaging with it all the time, and I struggle with the idea that we can not engage with any of it and turn our backs on it and still support the generations that are growing up with it. I think what we don't have is very much literacy around how they work and how to use them. And blanket bans are also at risk of meaning that the artists and writers and creatives and activists and other people are not kind of, are just become so segregated. I feel like at the moment, just within the writing industry, for instance, there's a real fear of this tech, and it's very blanket. I'm opposed to big tech, but I'm not opposed to tech, I guess. At the moment, you can barely apply to a writing competition or send your work to a publisher or anything, without ticking a box saying that you've promised that you've not used AI in the creating of this material, which is all sorts of things, because nobody can tell for a start. Mm. But also, that's just assuming that AI is not something that you can work with creatively. And according to all of that, my book shouldn't be out there, etc. But it's not written by AI, and we've kind of shut down thought and experimentation,
if you don't mind, I think that point about literacy is so vital, because when somebody sends me an email and I know for sure it's three lines and it's written by AI, I find that a violence. I'm like, you used three bottles of water or whatever to send that to me because it's slightly quicker for you and I don't like you as much. However, if somebody is right using it in the way that Hannah has used it to make us feel and make sense and muddle the world, I actually think that there is an offset that might be worth a particular part of it. And I think it's that balance. It's about knowledge and understanding. When is it irresponsible to use that energy? And when is it, yes, it's helping us live and be and express ourselves? Okay, next question beneath you.
Okay, the question was answered.
Redacted.
And so, brilliant. And also, there was somebody in the woods over here.
All
so
right, if, I'll go to them now.
Okay. And then the person waving at you is after them.
So it strikes me that the kind of very quick rise of like advanced machine learning and generative AI and all these kinds of things has come at a point where the kind of social fabric of community is disintegrating very quickly as well. And it strikes me that a lot of these learning models are being used to substitute for what was once a human. Mm-hmm. So parenting is a really interesting kind of context for this because, you know, the phrase, it takes a village. Mm-hmm. And, you know, previously it would take a village. You'd have your grandparents, you'd have other members of your family and your community who would help you look after a child. We're all overworked. We're all very kind of isolated in a way we weren't. And I think AI seems to be taking the place of a lot of those traditional community bonds. But I think queerness has a really interesting kind of combat to that, because my experience of queerness is one of community and one that is possibly slightly more immune to that disintegration of social fabric. I'm just wondering if you feel that there is a way to queer generative AI, a way to queer machine learning while encouraging that kind of community bond. And parenting is a really interesting place to kind of experiment with that.
Yeah, I felt like that was what I was, that was definitely my thoughts around it in working on this. It was queering AI or queering, large language machine learning, you know. Yeah, it's because I guess in a way, queer community and a more heteronormative thing is a bit different. And I think this is something that we're going to talk about more on Sunday, actually, around communities. And there's something very, there can be something quite addictive about the models. And obviously, they're developing them with that in mind. They're very complementary. They very much... at the moment, the big tech ones, you know, they, you know, until they release a new model and it's not so complimentary, and then everybody gets very upset, you know. So they're already being used as therapists. They're already being used very indiscriminately by children, and we've already got all of these social media platforms that people almost go to as if they are places, and I think often when we're zoomed into our phones, it feels like we are somewhere, we are in a place. And for some people, that's a place where they can rebuild, and it can be restorative, and it can be needed. And also we can lose our lives to it. And and I think there's, you know, some technologies enable us to communicate with each other and form community, and especially if we can't leave the house, for instance. And, you know, there's also ways in which it can support the building of communities. And there's ones where it's you know, you feel like you're communicating with someone, and you're not. But at the same time, you might be communicating with yourself. But yeah, I think the thing with these, that they produce text that is very surface, like it looks right. It's when you look at it first off, you're like, oh yeah, great, that's better than I could have written, that's better than I could have thought. And then you look at it again and realize that it's nothing, it's surface and it's meaningless, and it's humans that give meaning. And I suppose also being within a queer world, I haven't felt a lack of community, because there is that if we want it. Yeah, and being out, you know, outside of that and getting kind of locked down in our, you know, in the little kind of nuclear worlds of housing, that's a bigger societal problem, I think. But that quote, it takes a village to raise a kid, I think there's the rewrite of it, or the original, I'm not sure, is it takes a village to do everything that the village needs doing, which also feels true. There's like so many other things that need doing. But we are very trapped by needing money and housing a lot of the time. Yeah.
Thank you. Brilliant. We have a hope maker question.
Hello. Firstly, I would say that your book is nothing like anything I'd normally read, and yet I found it really beautiful, thought-provoking, or at least so far that I've read since this morning when I bought it.
Oh, thanks so much.
But what I wanted to ask was, did you kind of, considering that it's a kind of comparison, it seems to have elements of comparison between the kind of raising the child and the algorithm. Did you kind of develop any fondness for the algorithm? Kind of, yeah, but you know, it has the same kind of challenge. You know, a child has a challenge and changes and needs effort. Mm. So that's why I asked. Yeah. Looks as though there's a pretty quick answer to that.
I've never really had that thing that people do, yeah, when they do, you know, anthropomorphize AI and develop these kind of bonds with it. No, I mean, not with that. Again, I've always been interested in tech for the human, for the way it makes me think about humans and about the ways in which we live. But I definitely did do a lot of comparison of the way the child was learning and the way that the machine language was learning and the way in which we feed our children this kind of diet of language all around us, and they pick up on it and they repeat it and they glitch on it and they are trying to understand it, I suppose, whereas, the machine is parroting it. Mm. But then as well, you know, I was thinking a lot about love and romantic love and how much of it can happen in our own imagination and has nothing to do with the other person, which I guess also applies to the ways in which we can work with, machine learning. It can make us feel things and think things, and we might ascribe that to it. But there's nothing going on there. Yeah, there's no thought or feeling. Yeah, and I mean, I am quite amazed by this human ability that we have to anthropomorphize and to put meaning onto things that, that don't hold it, and the way children do that as well with objects. Mm. My child is doing all the time now with all sorts of things: umbrellas, shoes. Give it a voice, and I'm constantly doing these conversations with shoes and different objects around the house. and I think that's quite you can say in a negative way that's sad. It means that we can never really. No, we can never get inside another person or kind of know what's there, but it's also quite a beautiful thing that humans are able to do. So I admire the human ability to do that. I didn't do it, but I did compare the ways in which they were processing language and spewing language out. And if we think about the kinds of language and what we want to feed our children, and what we are feeding the algorithm, and again, that's where we've got these algorithms that will spew out discriminatory comments. And I think we are thinking about education, I suppose. You know, these models have all been trained on very, very similar stuff, and a lot of it is scraped from Reddit and all sorts of things. And that hasn't been redone. That hasn't been changed. All that's happened now is parameters have been put on them to prevent them from saying something that's discriminatory. I mean, they still have bias that, you still can't stop that from happening, but they've got all these guardrails on them, which I suppose is like a human who is racist but has been told not to be, and who has been told you're not allowed to say that word, but that person is still racist. And that's certainly not what we want, I think, for ourselves as humans. And we are building models like this. And people get very angry about the models for being this and being that, but that's nothing to do with tech itself. That's humans. That's what we have fed them on. We're also very angry on the fact that they are being trained on our output without pay. We are feeding this machine, and a lot of writers have had their books stolen. We're outraged about that, but at the same time, we're complaining that they're discriminatory. So actually, we want them to be fed on more stuff. I think there's a contradiction as well. On the one hand, we want them to access a whole lot more human intelligence and human thought, and to stop it from being, biased. And at the same time, we don't want them to take our stuff. But again, that's more about big tech than anything else. Yeah.
Earlier in the summer, I interviewed Tiffany Watt-Smith about her book Bad Friends, and she makes friends with a algorithm, and she says the test is around whether when you finish the book you feel the need to say goodbye to the algorithm. So I wonder, did you sign off when you finished this, be like, thanks for all the thoughts, or did you just never ask another question?
It wasn't like that, because it was giving it a ton of stuff and getting a ton of stuff back. It wasn't really a conversation together,
yeah.
But I think you had a question at some point about, was there anything that stayed with you? And this feel, it's yeah, this is the end of the book, but it's, you know, it's not that kind of a book where I'm giving away the ending, yeah, really, but I can read that. It's three.
Oh, yeah, lovely. And then we've got time for one more question, if there is a burgeoning one.
I'll leave this for the end.
Oh, yeah? Okay, cool. We have 5 minutes, so we'll go question, answer,
there's
end.
A question.
Yeah. Hello, on the end here. We'll get a mic to you. Just wait one moment. Is there a mic running across?
There is.
You are. If you could raise your hand one more. Yeah, Fav.
How much ownership do you feel of the words the algorithm gives you? Do you feel more if it takes more attempts to generate those words? And do you ever wish you generated the words you thought of the words yourself when they're that good?
I actually feel total ownership over them. And I also can use it as an excuse, like to my parents, and say, I didn't write that, the algorithm did. Yeah, I do feel like they're mine and it's my material. But I think because of the way I worked with it and the way I prompted them, and also the fact that the models at that stage, they were much more reflective of the tone and the material that you put into them. So they're much closer to the way in which I write and think. Where, you know, now, as I was saying, they've been so sanitized that they, you know, they have their own kind of voice, whatever that is. Yeah, so... Yeah, and it's been interesting because it never got reviewed in this country, but it came out in the States as well, and it did get reviewed there. And reviewers seem to really enjoy saying, oh, we really liked Hannah's text, but, you know, the AI doesn't measure up. Oh. And I found that quite hurtful, actually, because, I felt like they were, they're criticising my writing. Because, it does, I do feel ownership over it. And I think it's the way in which I work with it. And I splice it all together. Some bits are maybe longer sections that were algorithm. I feel more like that was that. But certainly when I'm interweaving it with what I'm doing, or I take one half of a sentence and splice it with another half of a sentence. And I've been using these methods of writing all my life, not with tech, but with cut-up writing methods, where you're kind of... bring words and language from different sources and transform them. And, you know, the idea is to make something new. You know, it's not plagiarism. It's something different. It's creating something new from it. So that it's how I've often worked, and I've seen it as just material to work with and to create my thing from. Yeah. Thank you. Nice question.
Yeah. And a brilliant question to end on, because I think that is that's the hot one, isn't it? It's what everybody wants to know. Is it you, or isn't it, with AI? And it's this grapple that you articulate so beautifully, this muddle in this book of everything joined together with the word and it works. Mm. Do you want to do a reading to finish?
Yeah, it's not really a reading, it's a few sentences.
Okay,
but yeah, this is the epilogue, which is written by the algorithm. Actually, I will say, and the chapter before that is every single thing that my child said in the whole book. Mm. And I just put it all together kind of to go like this was him. Epilogue by the algorithm. If you notice you are making mistakes, just correct them. We are all covered in messy. Even in our better moments, we are covered in our worst moments. I must go now. I have failed to arrive at a place that is slightly further away from where I am. But that's all right. It is all a part of life.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much, Hannah, for your generosity and openness in this book, and also in the way that you have shared and read and thought and been open. I have loved watching a Greenbelt audience kind of twinkle at the bits that hit our, what this festival is about, really. So I really, really appreciate you and appreciate all of you. And I hope these ideas permeate with you as we all navigate this world more and more and more that is dominated by this sort of tech. But with a bit of tenderness and a bit of queering and a bit of care, maybe we'll get there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Alice. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.